Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is medical epidemiologist, Dr. Stephen Lamb. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So you are a medical epidemiologist. That kind of threw me at first, but we talked about it. An epidemiologist is a person who studies or is an expert in the branch of medicine which deals with the incidence, distribution, and possible control of disease. So that kind of threw me at first because I was thinking something else, but now I've learned something about what an epidemiologist is, and so that's very cool. And you are on the faculty of both Johns Hopkins and Georgetown Universities. Tell me what you're doing these days.
Correct. Well, first of all, the definition you gave of an epidemiologist is sort of a textbook definition.
Mm-hmm.
The first way to think of it is that an epidemiologist is somebody who studies epidemics, as opposed to someone who studies skin disease.
Right.
And which is a standard misunderstanding.
Yeah, so even I fell for that.
Right. An epidemiologist studies epidemics. What is an epidemic? An epidemic is when some thing like a disease occurs much more frequently than would be expected. And so an epidemiologist is someone who looks at the pattern of the disease in a community and tries to figure out what are the determinants that caused it to have that pattern, and therefore what control might you do in order to prevent it.
So that gets into things like transmission vectors, like the way people interact with each other, social interactions, how the disease is transmitted by touch or by air, certain kinds of social gatherings. I assume all that comes into play.
Well, that does, but they get more involved in things like, for instance, the spread of the Zika virus, that if you eliminate the mosquito, then you've eliminated the transmission, that type of thing. Or where more of my work is either when you're worried about chemical pollutants in the drinking water, you want to bring the level in the water down below the level at which it causes disease.
Right. And we're going to get into some of the technical aspects of that in the later part of the show. I thought that was fascinating. Mm-hmm. So how did you become an epidemiologist? What was your life course that kind of led you into that?
Well, first of all, before becoming an epidemiologist, I became a physician. And before being a physician, I was a chemist and had my degree in biophysics, where I was busy trying to understand at a more molecular level what was really going on in the body, both in sickness and in health. I found the more I studied it and the closer I got to the cellular and microcellular levels, the less relevant it seemed to be. So when I got into medical school, I began looking more broadly. And that led me into the field of epidemiology. What causes the transmission of disease? How do you prevent it? One of my projects in medical school, for instance, was that I worked in northern Nigeria for 3 months on the control of smallpox and running a vaccine program there and immunizing, say, 1 million people.
Well, I thought smallpox was gone.
It was. It is. But in 1968,
when
I did this,
okay,
it wasn't gone. But I was part of the big program that led to its elimination. I was a very minor part of that, but a part.
Are we at risk of smallpox making a comeback, or is it really, really gone?
It is really, really gone.
Cool.
With the exception of if somebody used it for bioterrorism. And even then, there are very few places where the virus is, and it's kept under tight control.
So do all nations have stockpiles? I'm curious. Or just some countries have stockpiles to study the virus?
I believe that it's only the United States and Russia. that have stockpiles of the virus.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, I'm glad it's gone. Right. So you told me the other day that as you're working on your MD degree, you sort of, quote, moved from the microscope to the macroscope and started looking on how diseases interact with the population and why people get sick. I'm sure there are many, many studies on that, but can you kind of bring it down to earth level and explain how some of these diseases get transmitted and how people can help avoid getting diseased? Is that a reasonable question?
Yeah. Obviously, it varies by what disease you're talking about. For instance, early in my career, I was working for the CDC in the Connecticut State Health Department. And one of the issues I got involved in was the occurrence of salmonella infection in young children. And what I did was to phone up the families where the cases occurred. And one of the things that struck me is that a lot of the families had recently acquired a pet turd. So we ended up comparing the frequency of turtle ownership in cases of salmonella versus frequency of turtle ownership in cases of shigellosis and for other comparisons. And we found a very strong association. And we pursued that. And we could then demonstrate the mechanism of transmission of that the bacteria was in the turtles. It was transferred by the children's behavior to the children, and the net effect of it was that the FDA banned the interstate transport of such turtles, and with it reduced the incidence of salmonellosis in children by about 17%.
I have a question.
Yep.
So just curious, is salmonella something that is native to all turtles? It's part of their biosphere? Or is it something they pick up in a pet store and transmit on?
It's probably something that they pick up around the time of their birth. One of the major transmissions is that the mother has it, deposits it onto the egg, and that the egg is soft at that point, just after delivery, and so the bacteria get into the egg.
If they want to purchase a pet turtle at the pet store, does the pet store have to go through some sort of cleaning process certification?
No. Basically, they can't get those types of turtles anymore. There's no longer a market. The fascinating thing is that it turned out that these turtles, for the most part, were raised in ponds in Louisiana. And which bacteria got into what set of turtles, because it's very different turtles had different salmonella strains, turned out to be based on what food was given to the turtles in the pond, because turtles are meat eaters. And so if in one place the animals were put in, such as one raiser I went to, when I visited them, had a contract with the local sheriff, and dead horses that they found were then put into the turtle ponds as food. So there are different transmissions of the bacteria from one animal species to another animal species, so that you have the same bacterium that may have been in a horse. It then gets transferred into a turtle, and then it gets transferred into a human.
Wow. So is this something that happens similarly in the pet kingdom or in the food supply, or is this, was this a special case? I mean, it sounds like this is a big field of study, something you could really spend a lot of time on.
Well, there are. I mean, today one has more of a problem with reptiles than with turtles. But it is approximately every 10 years one sees another outbreak showing up and people have forgotten the lessons that we learned in the past.
Mm.
But most of your salmonella transmission, rather than coming from animals directly, comes from eggs. So that if you have contaminated eggs that are go in, or chickens or such. So it's really, today it's more of a food problem than an animal problem.
Yeah, I've often wondered about that. Every month or so, it seems like on the news, there is some recall from some food manufacturer. Then typically it is salmonella. Sometimes it's something else. And large quantities of food have to be recalled from the grocery stores. How does a food processing plant typically, I don't want to get into any legal details, but how does salmonella arrive in the processing of food, you know, when you're selling some packaged product?
Well, either in the raising of the product or in the processing of it. And it's the job of the manufacturer, if you will, to be testing the product in the production line. And if it identifies, the purpose is, if early in the production line you identify that salmonella is coming into your plant, then you stop that production. You clean it out, you start all over again.
How does it get into the plant?
It can be, you know, such as, for instance, if you're using chickens normally have them. It's part of the environment in which chickens are.
Mm.
You often have it that vegetables may have been contaminated in the field, or they may have been washed with contaminated water and so on.
Okay.
It's the job of the manufacturer to understand the critical points where the hazard may occur, to monitor those and stop them before the product gets into the marketplace.
Very good. Well, we need to move on.
Good.
So after you got your medical degree, what did you do next? Did you start the consultants in epidemiology at that point?
No, I first joined the Epidemic Intelligence Service at the CDC.
Oh, Maren McKenna talked to me about that. I did a show with Maren McKenna a few weeks ago, and she talked about that. That must have been a lot of fun.
Absolutely. You're there with the cream of the crop, and the things that are actually happening are the things that you spend your time on.
Tell us what that group does.
Basically, what it has two groups of epidemiologists. It has epidemiologists that they send to the various state health departments and some city or county health departments, whose job it is to look at the diseases occurring there and identify when something is out of the ordinary, sort of an early surveillance program. The origin, in fact, for the whole program was set up for the purpose of basically what we today would call bioterrorism, but as a defensive program for early detection of biological warfare back in the mid-20th century. So that's one group. A second group are the epidemiologists who they have in Atlanta, and their people specialize in a particular disease or a particular group of diseases. And then they look at what the pattern is across the nation, and they work with a laboratory in terms of carefully studying the peculiarities of cases to figure out the mechanism, the transmission, and that sort of thing.
Cool. Well, this sounds like a good place to take a break. And okay. When we come back, I want to ask you about papers and posters you presented at the Society of Toxicology and your expertise on arsenic. And we'll do that when we come back. Folks, stay with us. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
We're back. I'm chatting with Dr. Stephen Lamb. So you told me the other day when we were chatting about how you presented some posters at the recently at the Society of Toxicology. Explain to the listeners first what a poster is at a technical conference, and then we'll get into the details.
Well, basically, there are two different ways of presenting scientific reports at scientific meetings. One is, which is called a platform presentation, where you stand on the stage, you give your talk, you have an overhead projection, and you show your slides that way and describe to the audience what they mean. So that everybody who's there is busy watching the same single presentation.
That's the one we're all familiar with.
Right. The alternative is that someone takes a presentation and has it printed out on, say, a 3x6 foot poster, which you then put up on a wall. And the people attending the meeting will walk along and look at the posters and stop to talk to the authors of the ones that interest them, so that they can be much more selective in what they're discussing. It also means that the people who have the greatest interest in what you're doing can come and discuss it with you particularly.
Cool. So one of your posters was about arsenic. It was fascinating, arsenic in drinking water. It's a really cool story related to how arsenic can or cannot cause cancer. Tell me about that. It's a wonderful story.
It's not so much an issue whether it can or it can't cause cancer. It's quite clear that it can and that it does. And we're talking now about exposure through arsenic, inorganic arsenic, in drinking water. But the question is not whether there is potential risk or hazard, but the question is at what concentration or what exposures is it hazardous? So that if you're exposed, it's well known that if your exposure is in the hundreds of parts per billion, that you have a reasonably high, that's what we call a high risk zone for lung cancer and bladder cancer. Where the dispute exists is if you look at the hundreds of parts per billion, we essentially don't see in the United States. There's been a few places in the world where that used to be quite common. But even there, it's no longer seen. The exposure levels that we have in the United States tend to be in the range of 1 to 10. And so the question is, can you take the risk at, say, 200 and just assume that the risk is proportional down to zero exposure?
A linear effect.
A linear slope. Or do you find that there's something strange about this, that it's only high-level exposure that causes it, and that at lower exposures, you don't have that same risk, even a proportional one?
This is interesting, because we've heard about the lead in the water at Flint, Michigan, and the news reports always point out that there is no level of lead in the water that's safe. But you tell the story. We were chatting the other day about concentration levels and moving across the membranes. I want to dig into that a little bit. So let's explore that further.
Okay, well, the statement that there is no safe level is, it's a bit of a frustrating statement, because we don't really know what it means by being safe. Generally, our data, when we're talking about low-level exposures, has so much variability in it that we really aren't sure what the real exposure is.
Are there physiological effects, like children are more susceptible, or people with different body chemistries or ages, and so there's some dispersion in what you think is a acceptable level?
That is true for a number of different chemicals. I'm not sure that that's particularly true for lead. It is true that with lead, the issue is the concern on the developing brain. And obviously the developing brain is an issue for the very young child. That's the reason why we're focused into it. Not that its metabolism is different.
Okay, so getting back to arsenic, you told me a fascinating story about these negative and positive coefficients, about the concentration of arsenic varying in not in a linear fashion. Can you explain that to the listeners?
Yes, well, the question is, one assumption may be that you assume that the risk is just a straight line. Well, what other models might fit? One might be what we call a threshold. That is, that there's a certain level below which there's no risk. And then when you reach the threshold level, now the risk occurs. And that it's a significant difference between the no risk and the high risk. Another may be that the line, rather than being linear, is linear quadratic. That is, it's both got a linear function and a quadratic in the equation, a square term. Now, what we found interesting is that when we looked at the data across all the studies that looked over the full range of from low levels to high levels, we found they generally seem to have a pattern, rather than being straight, a first sort of dipping down and then coming back up. And so we found that the best fit was to this linear quadratic curve. And most intriguing, we found that the linear term of it had a negative coefficient, which meant as you begin to go from no exposure equivalent to very low, the risk goes down, and it goes down for a while and then reaches a minimum and then turns around and goes up.
Where does that minimum occur in parts per billion?
The important thing is, where does it come back up again?
Mm-hmm.
And that turns out to be in that range between 100 and 200 parts per billion.
Oh.
Now, people ask you, are you telling me that arsenic protects you from cancer? I said, no, that's not what I'm saying. But we tend only to look at one side of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're going to find is arsenic does a lot of different things. And some of the things that it does is to stimulate pro-carcinogenic activities in the body, and others stimulate anti-carcinogenic. That is, there's a lot of protective mechanisms in the body. such as getting rid of abnormal cells and so on, that themselves might be stimulated by arsenic. So my sort of sense about it is, at very low levels, you're stimulating the anti-carcinogenic effects more than you're stimulating the pro-carcinogenic effects. But because the pro-carcinogenic effects are related to this quadratic term, once you begin stimulating them, then it really takes off and you come to a point where the rate goes up very markedly as you increase the exposure level.
These are details you don't normally hear on the news because it's too complicated a story.
That's why we're on Mac Observer.
That's right. Talking to another scientist who appreciates all this. Mm-hmm. So you told me the other day about how there was a double effect where, not maybe not a double effect, but there was an additional consideration when it came to arsenic levels and smokers.
Ah, yes. What I've just discussed is we demonstrated with respect to lung cancer. The other cancer, that internal cancer that arsenic causes, is bladder cancer. The fascinating thing about the bladder cancer data is that the effect is only seen in smokers. That people, and among non-smokers, there's again this suggestion of decreasing risk with increasing exposure down at the low levels. But with the smokers, you're finding an increase occurring at lower levels than the 200 parts per billion level. So it raises the intriguing question from a regulatory point of view. And that is, should you be setting the standards in order to protect subpopulation rather than the total population, and base it on so that you're setting the standard for everyone for the purpose of protecting the smoker from the increased risk?
Do everyday physicians, family practice physicians, know about these kinds of things?
Probably not.
Maybe IBM's Watson someday will be able to tell us things like this. Like, we'll go in and have an interview with the Watson AI agent, and we'll have a sit-down session, and Watson will ask you, I've looked at the sample of your drinking water, and everything's cool, but, oh, by the way, are you a smoker? So that's pretty cool. All right, so we've geeked out here.
From the physician's point of view, he would say, I'm not in a position to get you to vary the arsenic level in your water, but I am in a position to get you to work on reducing your exposure to cigarette smoking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in
that's
general,
a position that the physician would take.
Right, and it's a good general position to take, knowing about these effects, because we know smoking causes so many problems.
Right, and in particular, it causes both lung and bladder cancer.
Interesting. Okay, so we're just about out of time. We've come to the end of a very geeky technical session. I've got two more questions I want to ask you about. Well, first of all, it's a great story that I couldn't resist having you tell. You told me a story the other day about a startup company that you invested in, and it was really cool. Tell us, take a minute or so to tell us about that.
My niece and nephew were working for a .com out in California, and they were in a situation where the company basically said, we have this great product, we're doing well, but our cash flow isn't working. And I was basically told, if I made a small investment in the firm, that would be sufficient for carrying the firm long enough that my niece and nephew would stay in employment for another year. I figured that was a good enough return on my investment, so I made it. In the intervening year, it turned out that the firm was bought by Google, and the product became Google Maps.
Oh, my.
And the net effect of that is that that purchase took care of my daughter's expenses when she went to university. So I'm very satisfied and pleased with my pre-Google investment.
Well, just like here in Denver, Kyle Clark does a show called Next, where he talks about the good news. We often hear about people investing in family or friends, and the thing goes bust and they lose a lot of money. But I'm really glad to hear this story because, you know, it's like time travel. If you could go back in time and invest in the early startup of Google Amps, would you do that? And you go, oh, yes. And you lucked out. So that's a neat story. But some of the things that we talked about in the show were pretty technical and geeky and have to do with the culture and the medicine of public health. And they can get pretty technical, but if somebody wanted to read and get into this kind of these technical topics and learn more about what's going on, what kind of books could they read to sort of get up to speed on some of the things we've been talking about?
Well, when you asked me about references earlier, you wanted more along the line of references on epidemiology, per se, and for that I recommended a couple of books. Historically, the book The Microbe Hunters by Paul DeCroof would be number one.
We'll put that in the show notes.
Okay, second one would be, there were a series of articles by, but his name slips me, Bernard, I'm sorry, in the New Yorker back in the 80s. And more recently, there's been a very nice book, in fact, about the Epidemic Intelligence Service, entitled Inside the Outbreaks by Mark Pendergrast. And that's a very nice reading book.
Cool. I'll put that in the show notes as well.
And if someone wanted to ask me more specific things and get directions, they can contact me. My email address is steve@ceoh.com, Charles Edward Oscar Harry.
I was just going to ask you that, so thank you for telling the listeners how to contact you. Dr. Lamb, this has been a wonderful show. I really appreciated the insights you provided us and your career as an epidemiologist and some of these geeky details. Listeners, as Dr. Lamb said, you won't hear this stuff on regular podcasts. You only hear it with the Mac Observer's background mode. So, Dr. Lamb, thank you very much for being a guest on the show. It was wonderful.
You're quite welcome. And the fellow on the New Yorker, his last name was Rouche, Rouche. I think
Excellent.
Bernard.
Excellent. Listeners, thank you for coming by this week. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We had a lot of fun today, and we'll see you next week on Mac Observer's Background Mode.